You are Locked On Vikings, your daily Minnesota Vikings podcast, part of the Locked On Podcast Network, your team every day.
Oh, we are in a glass case of emotion. Welcome, everybody, to another episode of Locked On Vikings. I am your host, your pal, and the kid you copied off in math class, and today, a very sad boy. My name is Luke Braun. You can find me on Twitter at LukeBraunNFL. You can find the show on Twitter at Locked On Vikings. And today, I was going to spend the whole show hyping up Brian O'Neill. I might still get to some of it, but some news happened, and it is sad. Everson Griffin will not be a Viking in 2020. It's not particularly surprising. Most people with inside knowledge of the situation kind of understood that other teams were able and willing to outprice the Vikings and that Everson Griffin was going to follow the money and he wasn't going to do an Anthony Barr thing or something that he's actually done in the past, which is like take less money to stay at home. None of that this time. The Cowboys got him for a $6 million contract with $3 million in base salary and $3 million in roster bonuses, which I believe take place on a per-game basis, so he gets a little bit of that $3 million for each game he plays. According to Ian Rappaport and Darren Wolfson, it sounds like the Vikings were in the bidding war for Griffin up until the very end. They were going back and forth with the Seahawks, and then the Cowboys swooped in kind of out of nowhere and took the whole market by surprise and came in, blew Griffin away, and he took the offer. Griffin will come to US Bank Stadium in November. Of course, probably won't play in front of fans, or maybe not in front of many fans, but I'm sure that will be a warm welcome. He doesn't exactly leave Minnesota on bitter terms. So immediately, this doesn't mean a ton to the Vikings roster. Of course, it was already constructed kind of under the assumption that Griffin wouldn't be returning. And so you already have that de facto step up from Ifeadi Odenigbo. We've talked about that and his potential. We already have, you know, the kind of lack of activity in free agency. They didn't go out and find another edge rusher. They kind of thought, we'll get Griffin, and if we don't get Griffin, Odenigbo will play, and we're okay with that. That's always kind of been their strategy. So I think this is still within the bounds of the Vikings' strategy, but it is a bummer, right? Everson Griffin, I think he still has plenty in the tank. He has plenty of pass rushing moves. I think he wins in a fairly technique oriented way that is immune to some degree to athleticism drop. He's not somebody like, I don't know if Jadeveon Clowney has developed more technique or whatever, but Jadeveon Clowney would just like win with athleticism because he's just the most insane human on the planet. And he doesn't, like, once that goes away, he'll need to replace it with technique. And Everson Griffin does seem equipped to do that. So I think he's still got plenty of gas in the tank, and I think Dallas is a great landing spot for him. Because I think in Griffin's case, he probably is the kind of player you can't have on the field for like 50, 60 snaps anymore. I just don't think he will, like, he'll just get gassed and you'll lose him by December. But if you make him a 30 snap player, 40 snap player, you know, that's still plenty impactful and you can help keep him fresher throughout the season. That's what you got to do with those guys in their 30s. And the Cowboys are equipped to do just that and do so comfortably. They've got DeMarcus Lawrence over there. Don't they have Alden Smith? Like, they have a really good edge rushing core and they won't rely on Everson Griffin every single snap like the Vikings have in the past few years. And that, I think, makes it a really, really good situation for both Dallas and Everson Griffin. I think he's going to thrive over there, and boy, it's going to hurt. It probably didn't hurt that George Edwards, who, of course, he's been the defensive coordinator in Minnesota for the last, 6 years, is a senior assistant in Dallas. That probably helped a lot with this. But the negotiation sounds like it went kind of unexpectedly. And that's really unfortunate. But at the end of the day, I'm sure the Vikings had a chance to match or you know, raise Dallas's offer. They probably could have if they were willing to spend, you know, $7 million to get Everson Griffin instead of the six he got in Dallas. I'm sure they could have made that phone call and made that offer. I don't think that they were like robbed of the opportunity and they were totally willing to, but they just couldn't get to the phone in time. No, I think they did genuinely decide that $6 million was too rich for their blood and they weren't going to pursue Everson Griffin for that. That's how auction markets work. I personally think about six-ish million is a fair price for him, and while I do wish the Vikings had been able to, you know, tack on maybe 6.5, see if he'll take it, or 5.5 and see if he'll take a hometown discount, and who knows, maybe they did make those offers, but Everson Griffin decided to go, you know, stick with George Edwards or decided to take more money or whatever it was. But now, the way that I am familiar with Rob Brzezinski and how he works is that he earmarks money for certain tasks and then tries to go get them done. So he says, okay, but you know, we've got $5 million set aside that we want to spend on Everson Griffin. And if you don't get Everson Griffin for that $5 million, then he'll have a backup plan for what else he would want to do for that $5 million. So this might have been the reason, and this is purely speculative, but this might have been the reason that the Vikings didn't have a lot of movement on the free agency front in the last few months, because they thought that they would be getting Everson Griffin and they didn't want to go spend Griffin's money on something else while the bidding war was still going on, which means things could open up over the weekend and we might see guys come in and be added to the roster, or we could see the whole $12 million that they have roll over into 2021 and help out with that nightmare. And to be perfectly clear, and I've seen this sentiment like in my mentions and with other people talking about it, if you disagree, maybe you would have gone and offered, you know, $7 million to Everson Griffin. That's perfectly valid. I don't even know if I disagree with you. I am really on the fence. I think $6 million is about exactly what he's worth. And so you'd either have to like select to overpay him in a cap-strapped environment. And I don't know if I feel good about that, but Everson Griffin is good. It might be worth it. So I'm pretty on the fence about it. But if you do feel like more strongly convicted than I do, I wouldn't characterize it as a mistake. It just seems like you lost a bidding war, and that's not necessarily a failure in the same way that losing a game is. The thing about auction markets, and NFL free agency is an auction market where the player more or less goes to the highest bidder, is that you aren't rewarded for being the most correct on evaluating a player. You're rewarded for being the most optimistic about the player, the highest on the player. If a team came in and wanted to offer $20 million for Everson Griffin, they'd be very wrong, and they would also get Everson Griffin. And so you wouldn't call teams that declined to do that, you wouldn't say that they are failures. Like somebody said to me, like, this is just another Spielman blunder, which I think is hilarious because Spielman's blunders are much fewer and further between than his successes. But I think characterizing this as a blunder is kind of strange. It implies that, well, you know, that of course everybody would want to outbid the Cowboys for Everson Griffin, but they just like couldn't figure it out and didn't get there or made some mistake that everybody else thinks is obvious. And to that, I kind of say, if it were obvious that Everson Griffin is worth more than $6 million, the Cowboys wouldn't have gotten him at that price. It's perfectly valid to disagree, though, and say, no, I think that they should have gotten him for that money. I mean, I've made that same criticism about a bunch of cornerbacks, right? About like Nickell Robey-Coleman or Bryce Callahan or Mackenzie Alexander. I think the Vikings could have and should have outbid the teams that ended up getting those players because I don't think that they were high enough on those players. I think that is a perfectly valid criticism. If you think the Vikings just weren't high enough on Everson Griffin, I think that they were like over-evaluating how much his age was going to factor in and so on and so forth. I think that's totally valid, and I definitely wouldn't call you wrong. But I don't think it's right to criticize a team and a GM for being careful with their money and having lines that they won't cross. We can quibble about where they put those lines and if we agree with that, but they definitely shouldn't just gotten sucked into an endless bidding war and then get sucked into overpaying in a super cap-tight COVID environment. There's some other stuff that I kind of want to talk about with regard to this and its implications and Everson Griffin and stuff, and then I will switch to the Brian O'Neill content so we can end with a little bit of a palate cleanser after this very, very sad day. So stick around if you want your spirits lifted. So barring a different edge rusher signing, maybe they use the whatever money they were planning on spending on Griffin or they were willing to spend on Griffin and maybe they turn around and they go get some other edge rusher who's out there, like one of the guys I mentioned yesterday, then that is just that, right? And then you have extra pressure, and then suddenly Ifeanyi Odenigbo is in a camp battle, and that becomes really interesting, right? But without it, the roster is going to proceed the way that I've at least have been previewing it, with Ifeanyi Odenigbo being the de facto starter. DJ Wonnum, I guess, is competing, and like Kenny Willekes, I guess they're all competing for that job, but I think Ifeanyi Odenigbo kind of has it in until he doesn't, you know? And barring another signing, that's going to be the way it is. The other component of this that I want to talk about is the emotional component. I love Everson Griffin. He's been one of my favorite Vikings for forever. I mean, when he was drafted, I was in high school. So, like, my entire formative adulthood, I have spent rooting for Everson Griffin and falling in love with his personality and falling in love with his boisterous. He's wild. He's crazy. He's the sack daddy. He's a great guy. My heart just broke when he went through his mental health challenges in 2018. and seeing him come back and be the superstar he once was and having a phenomenal season, even if he dropped off a little bit down the stretch, but then he turned it on in the playoffs and he just destroyed the guards and like actually shut down that vaunted Saints offense and was like a key cog in doing that. I mean, that warmed my heart and it's a great fan memory that I'm going to cherish forever. And so losing him, of course it hurts and I hate it. I'm trying to be reasonable with like how I evaluate it and like, oh, was the contract, was it for too much? Would you have paid as much? I don't know. But I hate it. I want him to be a Viking, man. I'm going to miss the guy and it's going to hurt super bad to watch him sack the crap out of Kirk Cousins in like week 11 or whatever when he comes to play the Vikings. That said, I'm happy for the guy. I never do this with players, and maybe I should talk about it, but you should never, like, vilify players that, like, leave the team. I haven't seen much of that. I mean, people universally love Everson Griffin, so I don't think you're going to see that too much as sour grapes. I'm sure you'll see people be like, oh, he's old. We didn't need him anyways, but suddenly change their tune a whole bunch. But I think it still bears repeating. Don't be sour about former Vikings going to play for other teams for more money than the Vikings were willing to pay. Nobody owes anybody any loyalty or anything like that. It's a business, and we kind of have to understand that. And I would hope, I would predict that Everson Griffin, when it is time for him to hang it up, will sign a one-day contract at least and, you know, hang it up as part of the Vikings. Maybe even do a little retirement tour, vet minimum kind of year once he's totally washed and maybe just as a veteran kind of guy. And hopefully we see that, and his name will be up in the Ring of Honor someday, and it'll all be wonderful. But it is perfectly okay to be very sad and to miss the sack daddy. And the last thing I want to say on this, and then I'll move on to more bright and happy Brian O'Neill tape study stuff, is I think it's interesting to look at this from the perspective of the 2018 or the offseason after 2018, where Everson Griffin had basically no guaranteed money left on a huge contract. He had had a down year because that was when he had his mental health problems. And that's when he had, you know, that like down year and he came back and he clearly wasn't the same. And you basically had to bet, is he going to bounce back? And if he does, what does that look like and how much is it worth? And you kind of have to take a giant shot in the dark. And so what you do when you have to take a shot in the dark is you hedge all your bets, right? And basically they structured that contract to be a hedge. And Everson Griffin also wanted to hedge his bets because he wanted to be set up for a situation where, you know, if I play well, I don't want to be in a situation where I'm suddenly underpaid because we did this restructure after a down year. And that's perfectly fair. And that was something he negotiated very well. Or I suppose his agent negotiated very well, but he got this opt-out clause, which basically meant, all right, yeah, we'll have you on a deal that pays you very little, and then you have a whole bunch of incentives. I think it was like 6.5 sacks or something like that. He blew that out of the water, got like 15 or whatever, right? So he hits his incentive, and then his deal basically inflates back to being a real one. But if he hadn't selected to opt out, he probably would have been released or restructured anyways. So again, that was a situation where he was never really going to see the $13 million that he was on the books for in 2020. The Vikings never would have been able to afford to do that. They would have either released him or restructured him or had some other kind of pay cut thing go on. So instead, he took the opt-out, and now he gets a $6 million deal with the Cowboys, which does kind of stink, and I'm sure COVID had a lot to do with that and kind of drove all the prices down. I talked a bunch about that yesterday. But it's interesting because I think the Vikings played the Everson Griffin thing right. I think setting up a situation, I mean, obviously for the Vikings, it would have been better if he didn't have the opt-out and you just had control over it. But, you know, it's a negotiation. You got to cede something. So I think that they played it pretty well by having a contract that if Everson Griffin was totally washed, and they didn't know at the time, if he was totally washed and completely just was no longer ever going to be the same, or if he wasn't available, if he couldn't stay on the field, if things got worse, which again was totally possible at the time, they were set up for that. They would have been totally fine and they wouldn't have been like on the hook for a huge contract for a player that's given him problems. But in the event that he was good, they still had the option to have him on a deal that was good. If you still have a good edge rusher, and you know, if he played up to $13 million, they had the option to keep him there. So they had their options open, and that's really good. And it's unfortunate that that didn't work out in the way that it did, where now you just lose him outright. And you're not on the hook for a bunch of money, that would have been worse, but losing him outright is like the second worst outcome. So while I believe they played that right, it just kind of sucks that we got the outcome that means he's not going to be a Viking anymore. I mean, once a Viking, always a Viking, especially for Everson Griffin, but it's okay to be sad. But we don't have to stay sad. I am going to talk about Brian O'Neill for the rest of the show. And spoiler alert, he's really good at football, and you should be excited about him. And I'm going to back that up with tape and stats and all kinds of good stuff coming up, so you won't want to miss it. Stick around. So if you follow me on Twitter, at LukeBourneNFL, please give me a follow, you saw that before the heartbreaking Everson Griffin will not be a Viking news broke, I was posting some cut-ups of Brian O'Neill versus a couple of pass rushers who you may have heard of. One, Joey Bosa of the Chargers, and two, Za'Darius Smith of the Packers, just the Week 2 game. I haven't looked at the Week 16 game. Maybe I will someday. And all I did indiscriminately was find the snaps, the pass rush snaps, where those guys went head-to-head with Brian O'Neill and cut them up and posted them. And wouldn't you know it, for one, in both of the games that I mentioned, he didn't surrender so much as a pressure, but he was dominant. And there's actually some teach tape things we can learn about offensive line technique that we can talk about with this, and we can also talk about what it means to have a guy like Brian O'Neill and kind of what we, how we can set our expectations for him in 2020. So let's start with the first thing and actually showing how good he is. So one of the things, the first one I cut up was the Joey Bosa game. And something about Joey Bosa's game is that he has an absolutely lethal punch. And when I say punch, when I'm talking about the trenches, that means like the actual kind of shock you put out with your arms when you first engage. And if your punch is really, really like lethal, you can actually just get guys off balance, totally win the leverage battle and win a pass rush that way. And Joey Bosa does that to guys all the time. And this is particularly, I remember being particularly concerned about this headed into that Chargers game because Brian O'Neill's whole deal was that he was undersized and he'll beat anybody to the spot, and I'll explain that in a second, but once he gets there he usually had some trouble anchoring and he would cede a little bit too much space in the pocket. It would make it more difficult for the quarterback to run around. And that was kind of the book on him. He would anchor, he'd eventually get it there, and he didn't have this problem often, but really he would struggle a lot more when he went up against like true 4-3 defensive ends, guys like Everson Griffin, versus 3-4 outside linebackers that tend to be a little bit more finessey. This is like Melvin Ingram, who he went up against for most of that Chargers game and absolutely demolished him. But I wanted to focus on the Joey Bosa thing, because Joey Bosa, Ohio State, more of a 4-3 guy, and that should have presented more of a challenge. So to see him dominate in that game is really, really encouraging, and it displays an increase in power from his rookie year to now. And what that allows us to do is highlight Brian O'Neill's strengths a little bit more. And what his strength is getting to the spot. And so the spot, if you can imagine like an edge rusher versus a tackle, right? When you're an edge rusher, you kind of got to pick your angle. You can't just go straight at the guy. You might try to, you know, that's a bull rush, right? You could try to, but then you got to get through him and you're not making the offensive linemen work as hard. You're not making them get to a spot or move around before they engage. They can just kind of build their house and, you know, stronger man wins. If you go too far upfield, if you try to run too far, like away from that starting angle and like get too far upfield, then the quarterback can just step up into the pocket and totally neutralize you. It doesn't matter if you beat the offensive lineman or not. So you kind of have to find that happy medium. The thing is, the offensive lineman knows this as well, and they generally know how far upfield they can get before, you know, the pass rush is neutralized by being too far, and they kind of know exactly where they have to get to. So a lot of times it's a race to the spot where the offensive lineman starts a little closer to the spot, right? Because the spot's in the backfield, but he has to backpedal and the defensive lineman has to get to that spot. He has to go a little further, but he gets to run forward. Brian O'Neill, the athlete that he is, never loses this race. A big part of that is technique. He always gets enough depth on his kick step, for example. You kind of want to get as much depth as possible on that first step. Of course, you know, if you go too far, you could get beat like to the inside, but that's a little bit easier to recover from than just getting like beat around the edge for like super ugly, like TJ Clemmings would get beat that way all the time. Those would be those super ugly sacks. And in general, footwork and hand technique in terms of like deflecting those really gnarly Joey Bosa punches are things that look a lot better now by, you know, late 2019 than they did in the early parts of Brian O'Neill's career, like in his first in-game regular season action, which came the last year's Week 2 Lambeau game. There's also plenty of examples. There's not much in the cut-ups because I wasn't really focusing on these, but there's plenty of examples of like cerebral success too, where they'll try to throw some sort of stunt or twist on him, and he doesn't seem to get tripped up very much by that at all, which is very nice. And you see similar things with Za'Darius Smith, who is also a very like versatile rusher. He can beat you with power. He can beat you with like finesse or speed or whatever, and so you kind of need a just as versatile of an offensive lineman to kind of help with that. And Riley Reiff really isn't that, and that's kind of why he struggled. But a few times, Za'Darius Smith would go over to the other side and rush against Brian O'Neill, so it gives us a little bit of a sample there. There were six snaps that I found from the game that that I looked at, and it was, again, it was very, very good. And Za'Darius Smith, like, you can tell he is not an easy guy to block. I mean, this is elite competition, and again, you had very good hand-fighting technique. He was able to parry and deflect away some of the more, like, gnarly moves, and you see a great combination of that youthful athleticism with a veteran savvy that is now building up with 2 years of experience. He's developing in the way that is like all you could ever hope for with a draft pick like Brian O'Neill. When you draft a, you know, raw athlete type, a lot of guys comparing Ezra Cleveland to him, and when you make a draft pick like that, the like best case scenario is that he develops like Brian O'Neill is developing. It is really exciting, and I think it's okay for you to let yourself get excited. As long as he remains healthy, he should be a really good right tackle. And when you have a really good right tackle, what's awesome is you can leave them on an island. And I talked about this earlier in the week when I was talking about Chris Boyd. When you can leave a cornerback on an island and you can just trust them to do their thing, that means that you can kind of play 10-on-10 elsewhere on the defense, and that's really advantageous. There's fewer variables, and it's easier to control what goes on. Same concept kind of applies on the offensive line, and you can design plays around that. For example, you could run a bootleg to the right that requires Brian O'Neill to get out in space and block a really good edge rusher one-on-one to make that bootleg work. And what that can do is put the defense in a really, really tough spot. Let's say you go up against a team and they've got like one premier edge rusher, right? Like the Vikings are going to play the Texans this year. They've got JJ Watt. That's their guy. So if you're JJ Watt, or if you're, you know, the Texans, and you need to figure out what you're going to do with JJ Watt, you either put him on the right side. He has to contend with Brian O'Neill, and Brian O'Neill can effectively neutralize him, or at least, you know, fight him to a draw and limit his output. Or you put him on the other side. He goes up against Riley Reiff. You probably have more success. But if you now, as the Vikings, if you know that the only way they can get success with J.J. Watt, or enough success to like influence the game with J.J. Watt, is to put him on the left side and have him rush against Riley Reiff, then you can game plan around that. And you can run a bunch of zone runs to the right side, running away from J.J. Watt. You can do a whole bunch of things to make Riley Reiff's job a lot easier. It gives you a lot of options as an offensive coordinator, you know, and one as experienced and savvy and legendary as Gary Kubiak, will be able to make use of this. But what that means for our expectations for Brian O'Neill, and this is the third thing, is he's probably going to get put in harder situations this year to make up for deficiencies elsewhere on the line. If you don't have a good right guard, you can design plays that kind of put more of the pressure on the right tackle, but that means he's going to fail more often. And you'll take that, right? You'll take the, because having like a bad game for Brian O'Neill isn't going to be as bad as a bad game from, say, I don't know, Dakota Dozier or whatever ends up happening at right guard. It'll be the overall better option. But if you just compare Brian O'Neill in 2019 to 2020, it might look statistically like a drop-off. The offense is going to be better off for making that decision, but it, you know, it's just going to give him a harder job, and you're not going to do as well as at a harder job. It's a good thing that we get to do that. So if you do see a statistical decline in Brian O'Neill, don't panic. Look to see if his job got harder. And I think on the flip side, if suddenly Riley Reiff has a better season, I won't be particularly surprised, because, or if Ezra Cleveland does, you know, better than we thought he would. I mean, I wouldn't be surprised just because I'm high on the kid, but also because having a good right tackle can kind of make the left tackle's job a little bit easier. If you can commit to play designs that protect the left side and leverage the right side, and I think the Vikings can with Brian O'Neill, then that is going to make it easier as a left tackle, whereas last year, you know, Riley Reiff just ended up on an island all the time against the Khalil Max, and against, I mean, he played way more snaps against Joey Bosa and way more snaps against Nick Bosa, and he got his butt handed to him, at least by Nick Bosa and Za'Darius Smith. He actually did, Reiff did well against Joey Bosa as well. They really shut him down in that game, and I still remember it. It was one of the better tackle performances I've seen from the Vikings in quite a while. But I digress. The point is, if you only ever have to protect the left side, you can do that without there being too much cost. You know, I like remember back in 2016 when both the tackles were bad. It was Jeremiah Searles on one side and TJ Clemmings on the other, and it was a catastrophe. And you had to have a tight end on both sides chipping, and suddenly you only had three pass catchers. You could never craft an offense out of that. The tackles, I think it was Chris Wessling on the Around the NFL podcast that year, would say all the time, the tackles are holding the team hostage. And that is an extreme example. I don't think we'll see a team struggle like the 2016 Vikings struggled on offensive line in a long time. I don't think we're going to see that from the Vikings in a long time. It would take a truly unbelievable slew of injuries or like a COVID outbreak or something. So you won't get in the you need a tight end on either side chipping every play kind of thing. But if you do need to chip, only having one side you have to worry about with chipping is pretty good. And if you can get in a situation where they go, all right, fine, you're going to chip on the left every time, fine, we'll put Khalil Mack on the right side and rush from that side. Having a guy that can handle that is just so advantageous, and it's totally worth dropping his personal stats a little bit to make yourself a little, just to remove that variable and remove one moving piece and open up a whole bunch of other opportunities, and you can have more pass catchers go deep, and you can run more deep routes and run more play action and all of the great good stuff that made the 2019 offense great. That is, in a lot of ways, unlocked at the beginning by Brian O'Neill. It's why tackles matter. So, yeah, I don't know. Take your shirt off. Get hyped. Let's do it. I'm all in on Brian O'Neill, and if I'm wrong, I'll be sad. But I sure don't think I'm wrong. That's going to do it for this episode this week of Locked On Vikings. We will see what happens over the weekend. I anticipate that it is going to be an eventful one. So we will come pick up all the pieces back on Monday. I will see you all then. In the meantime, of course, you can find me on Twitter at LukeBraunNFL. You can find the show on Twitter at Locked On Vikings. The show is available wherever you find your favorite podcasts, or you can always ask your smart device to play podcast Locked On Vikings. Works on your phone, Alexa, whatever. I'll see y'all next week, and as always, Skol.